We have this afternoon Robert C. Post from the Yale Law School to deliver the McCorkle Lecture. Robert graduated from Yale Law School in 1977. He has a PhD in the history of American civilization from Harvard in 1980, clerked for Chief Judge Bazelon of the D.C. Circuit and then for Justice Brennan, practiced at Williams and Connolly, went to teaching at Berkeley, and was there for 20 years even, and is now the inaugural David Boies Professor of Law at Yale. Robert Post is a scholar of astonishing scope and productivity. Among his many projects is a volume of the Oliver Wendell Holmes Devise History, with which most of us are familiar. Robert inherited, if that's the right way to put it, from Robert Cover, the volume on the Taft Court covering the years 1921 through 1930. And not surprisingly, he has written articles on the Taft era and on the achievements of William Howard Taft. But he's also written articles on anti-discrimination law, on constitutional theory, on law and culture, and most prevalently and prominently on the First Amendment. It's the latter scholarship that I know best, and so I might talk about it for just a minute. I think it's fair to say that Robert Post is the premier First Amendment scholar of his generation. His work is characterized by elegance, insight, a quite extraordinary range, both horizontally and vertically. Now, by horizontal range, I mean the breadth and variety of the topics within the general field of the First Amendment on which he has written. He has written more than once on defamation, written again more than once on outrageous speech, which is a category, if not precisely doctrinal, at least is familiar. He's written on the problem of racist speech, on blasphemy and pornography. He's written on the doctrine of the public forum, on the legal regulation of gossip, on sexual harassment. He's written on subsidized speech and on what I think is the very different topic of compelled subsidization of speech. He's written on vagueness, which, if not precisely a First Amendment topic, has application mostly in that context. He's written on commercial speech and on compelled commercial speech. And he's written on the values of the First Amendment, including, for example, articles on equality and autonomy in First Amendment jurisprudence and on community and the First Amendment. Even more impressive to me is his vertical range. He has written at the fundamental level of organizing principle, what we generally call theory, all the way down to detailed and nuanced understanding of doctrine. And I'm very much indebted to Vince Blasi for educating me on this point. At the level of principle, Robert Post distinguishes between public discourse and managerial speech. Public discourse is participation by individuals in the processes, both formal and informal, of collective political self-determination. This is the kind of speech that lies at the core of the First Amendment rhetoric, and it's the kind of speech that is most readily understood as warranting the very robust constitutional protections that we associate with free speech. Managerial speech is related to implementing the objectives and the priorities that are selected by our society. Managerial speech is often located in particular organizational structures and is typically concerned with particular tasks. And those tasks and those structures have their own internal logic, which often requires that speech be structured in certain ways. Post contends that modern First Amendment thinking errs by conflating these two categories, and specifically by assuming that the principles appropriate for disabling government regulation of public discourse apply equally to restraining government regulation of managerial speech. His broad point is that the regulation of managerial speech is better understood if insulated from the doctrines that govern public discourse. Let me offer commercial speech as an example. Ordinary commercial advertising is not, at least not to my observation, part of what Post thinks of as public discourse, because ordinary commercial advertising is not the kind of speech through which we as individuals participate in forging a collective political identity. And it follows for him that the very robust, nearly absolute protections afforded to some varieties of public discourse probably are inapplicable to commercial speech. Of course, commercial advertising does dispense information, and often that information is desirable and valuable, and on that ground, some constitutional protection is warranted. But, importantly, regulators who can validly claim that by restricting commercial advertising, they're actually improving the accuracy and the informativeness of the speech should have their regulations upheld. Thus, for example, this is a testing case that I think makes the point clear. Thus, for example, Post supports the proposition that commercial speech can be regulated if it's misleading, a proposition that would not be and should not be applied to political discourse, to public discourse. Just think what would happen in political campaigns if misleading political speech were actionable. And it follows, I think, for Post that he opposes, or at least is doubtful about, the recent drift of precedents in the commercial speech area that move toward a more nearly absolutist protection, that move toward a conflation of commercial speech with public discourse. Now, this is an elaborate argument which I've described briefly and inadequately, but perhaps it suffices to show that Robert Post's thinking about public discourse versus managerial speech is thinking at the highest level of abstraction and comprehension. It is an organizing principle for understanding the First Amendment. It is the kind of grand, overarching perspective that lawyers, or at any rate law professors, call theory. But Robert Post is also deeply interested in and deeply informed about the architecture and the details of contemporary doctrine. He has written often and rigorously about specific decisions, and he draws from close analysis of those decisions insights that build from the specific to the general, as well as propounding theory that brings general wisdom to the specific. Thus, in both the horizontal breadth of his scholarship and in the seamless vertical reach from organizing theory to doctrinal detail, in his ability to join big ideas with lawyerly reasoning and meticulous attention to detail, he is a truly outstanding scholar and, as I say, in my judgment, the preeminent First Amendment scholar of his generation. Now, having said all that, I understand that today he's not going to speak on the First Amendment, so never mind. He also writes on political theory, among other topics, and his topic for today, originalism as political practice, the right's living constitution. Welcome, Robert Post.
Thank you so much, John, for that wonderful introduction. It's the kind of thing where you feel like you're witnessing your own funeral. It's marvelous. And very moving, very moving. And I thank you all for having me here on this glorious day in this beautiful town. And I thought I would talk today about something other than the First Amendment. I would talk about originalism. And the piece I'm about to talk from is co-authoring with my colleague Reva Siegel. So I'm going to be using the first person singular here. I'm talking about me, but you should understand that everything here is really a we. It's really co-authored down to the ground. So everything I say, she should get equally credit and blame for, depending on what you think of it. So I'm going to be talking about originalism, and there is much written about originalism. It's a topic about which many of us in this room have spilled ink. I have myself visited the University of Virginia Law School and debated the topic of originalism with Professor Harrison. I've written about it. And generally when we talk about originalism and debate it, we talk about whether it's right, whether it's wrong. That is not my topic for today. I'm not going to talk about whether originalism is attractive or unattractive, whether it's accurate or inaccurate, whether it's feasible or infeasible. Instead, I'm going to ask a different question. I'm going to ask a sociological question. I'm going to ask, what makes originalism so successful? why has it become so authoritative in our understanding of the Constitution? And when I say successful, what I mean is, of course, it has become the organizing principle, say, for the Justice Department under the Reagan administration, when Attorney General Edwin Meese said, this department will pursue a jurisprudence of original intention. This is the policy of the department. It is successful in the sense that judges have been appointed who affirm originalism as a philosophy of judicial interpretation. And most importantly for my purposes, it is successful because it is the medium through which many organizations mobilize. You see on the conservative end of the spectrum many, many organizations ranging, say, from the Catholic Eagle Forum of Phyllis Schlafly to the Protestant Focus on the Family of James Dobson, a convergence on the notion that we want to organize to pressure the president to appoint judges who will be originalists, who will be faithful to the original meaning of the Constitution. Now, I know in history there are many instances of mobilization around constitutional issues. Should there be slavery? Should there not be slavery? Should their labor be protected? Should labor not be protected? I know of no other instance in American history, and this is the center of American history, so I'm happy to, legal history, I'm happy to get advice, but I can't think of another example where people mobilize around a methodology of judicial interpretation. This is quite an unusual phenomenon, and it takes place in the late 70s, and it is that phenomenon, the success of that phenomenon, that I want to query today and ask, how is it that this form of reading the Constitution should have such political support and should develop such authority within the jurisprudential sphere? So the first thing I need to specify is what I'm talking about when I talk about originalism. From the very beginning of the nation, Americans have used many means of interpreting the Constitution. They've looked at text. They've looked at the original intention of the framers and of the ratifiers. They have looked at structure. They have looked at precedent. They have looked at generally does it make sense or doesn't make sense. Many, many forms of reading the Constitution, of which the notion of text and the notion of original meaning has always been one. So some version of what we would technically and jurisprudentially call originalism has been around forever, more or less, since the Constitution itself. But when I talk about the rise to authority of originalism, I'm talking about a specific historical phenomenon. And I'm going to characterize that phenomenon by two factors. The first is that it is said, and was, we're talking here about a philosophy which comes to prominence around 1980. The first academic that I can think of who is doing this in a self-conscious way is Raoul Berger with his book in 1977, Government by Judiciary. But the claim is that there is only one way to interpret the Constitution. Only one way. Only one. And any other way is illegitimate and improper, and this one way is the original intent of the framers. So the first historically specific criterion I'm using is this claim of exclusivity, that any other way to read the Constitution besides the original intent is improper, and that's most unusual. You know, you can think of Black, more or less, but on the whole, this is a very modern claim and very unique claim, and part of the reason you see this claim, I want to say, is because originalism develops as the historical phenomenon I'm talking about as a way of attacking the precedents of the Warren Court. Historians who study the rise of originalism plainly make this connection. I'll just read you something from Keith Whittington, who's a political theorist at Princeton. He says, originalism was a reactive theory motivated by substantive disagreement with the recent and then current actions of the Warren and Berger courts. Originalism was developed as a mode of criticism of those actions. So what happens is you have a liberal court, the Warren court and the Berger court, and you have a reaction against it that wants to say those decisions are wrong. So you need some ground to appeal to apart from the precedents of the Supreme Court. What do you appeal to? You appeal to the Constitution itself, and this becomes a ground for criticizing Warren and Berger Court precedents. So this notion that there's only one way is really part of the political force of the rise of originalism. So that's my first criterion of the historical phenomenon. The second criterion is the really unusual one, and that is this claim of the exclusivity of the way of interpreting the Constitution is, how should I put this, a mobilizing force on the right. it becomes a medium through which many different right-wing groups come together and become mobilized, aroused, and politically active. You see lots of groups, from anti-abortion groups to anti-criminal rights groups, who pressure the president to appoint justices who will be faithful to the original Constitution, meaning they will reverse the liberal precedents of the Warren and Burger courts. But the point I'm emphasizing now is originalism becomes a means of arousing voters on the right, who then come out and vote for a president who will appoint the right sort of justices to create the right sort of constitutional law. So I'm talking about a phenomenon which has political roots and ties politically to the claim of the exclusive way of interpreting the Constitution. Now, my question is, how is it that this phenomenon becomes so successful? And in order to understand that phenomenon, I have to make a distinction at the outset. I'm going to want to distinguish two aspects of originalism. The first is the jurisprudence of originalism. So one aspect of originalism is its jurisprudence, which is to say its theory of how to interpret the Constitution. And the second aspect of originalism is its political practice. Under the question of political practice, I'm going to be looking at the historical question of what do people who make claims about originalism actually do politically? How do they function in the political sphere? What are they actually doing and so forth? So first, let's deal with the jurisprudence of originalism. This is the kind of originalism that people like me debate. You know, we say, is it right? Is it not right? Is it feasible to interpret the Constitution according to the original intent? If we could know the original intent, should we be bound by it? Because isn't that the dead hand of the past? These are all jurisprudential questions, theoretical questions about how the Constitution should be interpreted. And at the level of jurisprudence, if you look back to the rise of originalism, and here I'm going to take someone who, to me, is the key figure in the rise of originalism, Edward Meese, Ronald Reagan's attorney general, one sees three arguments. The reason why I say, by the way, that Meese is the key figure is that it is Edward Meese who sees the political potential of originalism as a political ideology and uses it to forge an alliance and to forge political interest on the right, to create support for President Reagan's efforts to appoint a judiciary which will be responsive to right-wing constituent groups. So it's he who forges the key political, who has the key political insights and really serves as a nexus between the political groups who organize to support originalism and the jurisprudence of originalism. On the jurisprudential side, Meese writes many articles in favor of what he calls, and he always italicizes the phrase whenever you see it in one of his articles, a jurisprudence of original intention. And if you look at his writings, he gives three arguments for a jurisprudence of original intention. The first argument is there are three arguments. The first argument is a separation of law and politics. So I want to put here the law-politics distinction. So first argument is originalism preserves the law-politics distinction. Originalism is a neutral mechanism for deciding constitutional law that is indifferent to whether it's right-wing or left-wing, progressive or conservative. And in that sense, says Meese, originalism will preserve the Constitution from the threat of politicalization. So I'm quoting him now. He says, by seeking to judge policies in light of principles rather than remold principles in light of policies, the court could avoid both the charge of incoherence and the charge of being either too conservative or too liberal. A jurisprudence seriously aimed at the explication of original intention would produce defensible principles of government that would not be tainted by ideological predilection. So the first justification of the jurisprudence of originalism is to preserve the Constitution from the taint of ideology, from the corruption of politics. And the idea here is a jurisprudence of, in language which Mietzsche uses again and again, fidelity and authenticity as distinct from manipulation and corruption. So the first argument is the preservation of the law-politics distinction. The second argument is democracy. Originalism preserves the democratic intent of the founders. So what is the point here? The point is the Constitution binds because it's the will of the people. How do we know the will of the people? Because a given constitutional provision has been ratified either through Article 5 or in 1789 by the original ratification of the Constitution. So if we are faithful to the original intent of the ratifiers, we are preserving the democratic will which justifies the Constitution in the first place. So Mies says, quoting him, "Judicial review, if guided by text and original meaning, validates the consent of the governed, and it thereby," quoting him again, "expresses a deeply rooted commitment to the idea of democracy." So the second argument is it preserves democratic legitimacy, originalism. And the third argument is fixity. This argument that Mies puts on the table is we in America have a very unique kind of constitution. We have a written constitution. Why is the constitution written? So that it will be unchangeable, so that it will be permanent, so that it won't be subject to every passing fad and fancy. So Mies writes, our written constitution cannot bind or limit discretion or governmental power if it is not interpreted on the basis of an enduring standard. Thus, non-interpretivism is not only contrary to common sense, it is antithetical to the very notion and purposes of constitutionalism. So the point here is to express the fact that the Warren Court had allowed liberal ideological predilections to corrupt the original fixity of the Constitution, to interfere with it, to change it, and the whole point of a written Constitution is to keep it the way it was. So three arguments in favor of the jurisprudence, the first point. Now, bracket this jurisprudence for a second, and we can all talk about whether these arguments make sense or not make sense. Just put that to one side and look at a different question. Look at the question of the political practice of those who support originalism. If a sociologist were to come down from Mars and look at how people actually acted and what they did who said they were originalists, what did they do? And the point I'm going to make is, as a political practice, originalism contradicts each one of those three arguments, and rather blatantly contradicts each one of these three arguments. And this is not a point about hypocrisy or not hypocrisy. It has nothing to do with it. The point is that the political practice is proceeding along in a dimension and through mechanisms that are inconsistent with the overt jurisprudence or ideological content of originalism. Now, consider in this regard Mies' first point. Mies' first point is that originalism distinguishes law from politics and preserves law from ideological taint. Well, I don't know how, I guess not many of you were around during the Reagan administration or even now, but I want to say that there was no literate, politically literate person during the Reagan administration, and there's no politically literate person now who does not understand that originalism stands in for a certain political ideology. When Reagan was saying, I'm going to appoint judges who interpret the real Constitution as opposed to make law, everyone understood him to be appointing judges who had a political, certain kind of political point of view. In terms of the actual political practice, nobody accepted this claim at face value. Everyone understood the claim of originalist judges to be a claim of a certain kind of political content. So historians who write about this say that, and I'm quoting now, originalism made a grand entrance onto the public stage as the centerpiece of a conservative jurisprudential agenda. And everyone really understood this from the beginning. And Edwin Mies himself, when he was describing why have an originalism, he would he would say, we need to do it in order to, he said, preserve the Constitution from the left liberal, it's his words, left liberal agenda of the Warren Court, and to check, I'm quoting him now, the drift back toward the radical egalitarianism and expansive civil libertarianism of the Warren Court. Right? So when he justifies it explicitly, political terms, even though overtly he's saying we're having a law politics distinction. As a political matter, everyone understood this. And so if you look today at books on originalism, take an example, Phyllis Schlafly has just published 2 years ago a book called The Supremacist, the standard originalist critique of the modern court. And if you look at it, you see the preface is all about originalist methodology, and then there's chapters 1 through 9, and each chapter is a conservative agenda item, like federalism or abortion or affirmative action, and each one of these states out a conservative position. It's completely obvious the connection between the politics and the methodology, and no one really didn't understand that. So as a practical matter, the practice of originalism was thoroughly, and is thoroughly, I want to say, you can see this in the Bush administration appointments, is understood as a political matter, as a practical political matter, to be a move in a political game and to be associated with a particular conservative outlook. So it does not preserve the law politics distinction. It's simply one avenue for introducing a certain political perspective into the constitutional agenda. What about the second argument? The argument that the jurisprudence of originalism protects the original democratic consent of the ratifiers. Well, if you take this literally, what it means is the will of the Constitution maker is expressed at only one moment, the moment of ratification. And any attempt to change the Constitution apart from that momentary expression of will is a violation of democracy. That would have to be the premise of that argument. Now, notice that when the Mies Justice Department comes in, it comes in with an overt political agenda. In fact, we have now memoranda from the Mies Justice Department, which were composed in the 80s, saying, what do we want to achieve? What sort of Constitution do we want in the year 2000? If you actually look at what the Constitution is now as interpreted by the Supreme Court, as opposed to how it was interpreted in 1982, you will see that it's significantly different. And this was the result of self-conscious policies of judicial appointment by the Reagan administration, of litigation by the Reagan administration, of political pressure by the Reagan administration. So the originalism was used as a vehicle to change the Constitution, not to preserve it in its original form, at least in the form in which the Reagan administration found it. So this is an effort to change, not to preserve an original will. So how can we justify that? Well, it could be justified this way. It could be said, we want to change it, but we want to change it to the way it originally was. We want to go back to the original will of the ratifier, so the change is a restorative change. That would have to be the defense of the second point, that it preserves a democratic will. Any change that has been introduced by the use of originalism is only to get back to the democratic will as it was originally announced. That would have to be the argument. So I guess what I want to say is this. Think of that as a picture of politics. What we're describing here is originalism as a political practice. That's to say, originalism as it motivates voters to come out and vote for a president who will appoint justices who stand for a certain thing. Do you think for a minute that the voters read the latest issue of the American Historical Review or the latest books of history that come out to see what really happened in 1868 and they vote accordingly? What kind of picture of politics could that possibly be? Voters don't care about history. The voters who are mobilized by this don't study the details of the 14th Amendment or the First Amendment in 1791 or the original Commerce Clause in 1789. They don't read disinterested books of history. That's not what makes politics work in this country. That isn't what motivates people to come out and vote for a president who will appoint a certain kind of justice. The picture that what's motivating the political practice, I'm just talking now about the political practice of originalism, the picture that could be motivated by an attempt to get back to what an historian would tell us was actually happening 200 years ago, 150 years ago, is perfectly incredible. because that isn't why people actually come out and do anything. And in cultural studies, this is a distinction that's known as the distinction between history and memory. History is actually what happened at a given time, and it turns out it's very hard to know what actually happened. And that's the result of disinterested research of the kind of legal historians that you have in this law school who spend a lot of time trying to figure out what actually happened. And they have to bracket what they actually think should or should not have happened. And it turns out that's a very self-disciplining form of enterprise. It's very hard to do. Most people don't do that. Most people operate in a different dimension than history. They operate in the dimension of memory. That is to say, they view the past as a locus of value, of what's important, and they work from what the historian Jack Rakoff and many others have called a usable past. They want a past that makes sense to them, that reflects their values, and it is that past which motivates them. That's not the past of the second argument that we're looking at here. That's the past of what makes sense in that past that I can use now, as opposed to I want to know actually what the democratic will is. And the best expression of that form of memory, of that appropriation of the past that I know, is by Michael Oakeshott, who tells us that the practical man reads the past backwards. He is interested in and recognizes only those past events which he can relate to present activities. Politics is nothing if not practical. So if we look at the political practice of originalism, it's a practice that takes the past as it relates to a present agenda. And this is completely obvious if one looks at the history of originalist agendas. So take a simple example. Take Bowling versus Sharp. So you all know Brown versus Board of Education, right? That's the case, 1954, which says you can't have segregation in the South. As Michael Klarman has written, it's very, very hard to justify this decision on original grounds. Very hard. I mean, attempts have been made, but you really have to twist yourself in a pretzel to do it. Well, that's Brown. That's what the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment applies to the states. No state shall. Bowling versus Sharp concerned segregation in the District of Columbia, which is a federal territory, which is not a state. There is no equal protection clause that applies to the federal government, you might know. So how did they ban segregation in the District of Columbia? Through the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment, which is enacted in 1791. There is no plausible argument that in 1791, at a time of slavery, the original intent would have banned segregated education in the District of Columbia. Not even a shadow of an argument about the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment. And many academic originalists pointed this out, like Lino Graglia. He was saying, this Bowling versus Sharp, he says, in the heyday in the 1980s, he says, that's not original intent. We have to go back on Bowling versus Sharp. But there was no response whatever to Lino Graglia in the political practice of originalism. When Lino Graglia is writing these articles, it's completely ignored. And appropriately ignored, because it was on nobody's political agenda. Nobody cared about returning to apartheid and segregation in the District of Columbia. So the notion that this was or wasn't consistent with democratic will, understood as an historian, which is the argument I just gave you, would understand democratic will. That is, what actually happened in 1791, that's not the point. The point is, in memory, what sort of past do we want to make for ourselves? And so the history of this movement toward originalism, as you would expect, given the way that public memory works, changes as the agenda of those who were pursuing originalism changes. So at the very beginning, in the first flush of originalism in the early 1980s, we find Terry Eastland, who's Mises' assistant at the Justice Department, arguing that a jurisprudence of original intention would never permit the court to prohibit sex discrimination. Because we know that the framers of the 14th Amendment didn't want to prohibit sex discrimination. We know this because they turned on their allies in the anti-slavery movement, the feminist movement, and in fact it was read to be an amendment that concerned race, not sex. Well, the Supreme Court now prohibits sex discrimination. Is this now what does an originalist say about this? In the first flush, when sex discrimination was just a controversial thing, you found some originalists saying, well, we ought to go back on that we ought to permit sex discrimination by the states and by the federal government. Now no one says that. No, I don't know an originalist who makes this point persistently. Why? Because it's not part of a usable past, because it's not part of an agenda. Similarly, at the beginning of the originalist in the first flush of originalism, Edward Meese is saying the incorporation doctrine, which, as you know, is the application of the Bill of Rights to the states, that's not an originalist position. Now, that's arguable one way or another, but his interpretation of the history was the incorporation doctrine is just wrong as a matter of original understanding. So, for example, the First Amendment shouldn't apply to the states. You don't see originalists argue that now. It went out of fashion because it was no longer politically useful. It wasn't part of a reconstruction of the past to serve present purposes. So the notion that the political practice of originalism would actually preserve an original democratic will in the way that history, as opposed to memory, would analyze an original democratic will, I find implausible from the get-go, from the ground up, implausible. Originalism is and always has been the search for a usable past, which is perfectly appropriate because that's how we orient ourselves, by creating a usable past. But we shouldn't confuse that with this notion of the preservation of a democratic will. What about this third argument about fixity? Here the notion is, it's the text which tells us what is, and the whole point is to preserve in the text what our constitutional values are. Well, if you look at the political practice of originalism, you will find that it's suffused with values that have no textual orientation whatever. For example, the Republican Party platform, 1980-1984, say, we want to appoint judges who respect traditional family values and the sanctity of human life. Well, neither the sanctity of human life nor traditional family values are textual issues. You don't find anything in the text of the Constitution about the sanctity of human life or about traditional family values, and yet originalists were committed to these values. So there's nothing in the actual political practice of originalism which is particularly oriented to the text, much less to fixity. The notion that it would be fixed is precisely what we discussed under the heading of democratic will. It's not fixed. It changes as political agenda changes. So the point of this exercise is to say that the political practice of originalism and the jurisprudence of originalism are almost diametrically opposite. They are inconsistent in almost every respect. Now, one thing one could say to this argument is, well, of course they're inconsistent, because originalism is a philosophy about what judges should do. And I have been talking not about what judges do, but about the political practice of originalism. That's to say, what people do who mobilize to get judges appointed who are originalist. Political actors, attorney generals, presidents may have this political practice of originalism, but originalism isn't about what presidents do, it's about what judges do. And so it's unfair of me to point to this inconsistency. One could say that about the argument I just made, and to which I would respond as follows. If we're thinking about originalism as a political practice, and we want to say that is different on the bench than outside the bench, we need to have an example of what originalism looks like on the bench. And I take it that the two exemplars of originalism on anybody's list would be Scalia and Thomas. And if Scalia and Thomas represent what originalism is in its actual judicial practice, then there is very little difference, I want to say, between the political practice of originalism as I've analyzed it and on the bench and off the bench. The political practice of originalism is alive and well, I'd want to say, on the bench. Now, if Thomas, one could say, and I'm quoting now Mark Graber's analysis of Thomas, his originalism in major cases generally buttresses conservative policy preferences. No good reason exists why Thomas believes conservative historians when historians clash, or why he discards originalism completely when that philosophy is hostile to certain conservative interests. So Graber goes on to give examples. He says, Thomas votes to declare affirmative action policies unconstitutional, even though scholars believe that such practices were accepted by the persons responsible for the 14th Amendment. He votes to strike down restrictions on commercial speech, even though no scholar claims that the persons responsible for the First Amendment intended to protect advertising. A principled originalist, writes Graber, eager to overrule ancient precedents, might rethink precedents dubious on historical grounds, treating corporations as persons under the 14th Amendment. Justice Thomas has not. So one can go through the actual jurisprudence of Thomas and see exactly what I'm describing here, namely his originalism is a function of memory. It's not a function, actually, of history. And I think Thomas, to be fair to him, is quite frank about that. So I look at a 1789 speech. I look at a 1989 speech about 1789 that Thomas gave to the Federalist Society at Harvard. And he announced in that speech as follows. He said, "I take my stand firmly with Frederick Douglass, who defied Americans to find a single pro-slavery clause in the Constitution." Now, I want to submit to you, no reputable historian would credit that for a second. But Thomas says that. So he is not interested in what reputable historians will tell you about the Constitution. He's interested in what's good about the Constitution, what's right about the Constitution. And when he explains to you what does it mean for the Constitution to be good, he said this in that speech. He says, "The conservatism that I know has appeal because it reflects a belief in the good sense and decency of the American people, and hence in freedom as the main source of all that is good politically. And what can be more conservative than the revolutionary principle that America was founded on, that all men are created equal?" That's the good that he finds in the Constitution, and which he overtly, explicitly identifies with a conservative ideology. And that's what I'm suggesting the political practice of originalism is, and that's what Thomas is saying explicitly that he does. And I would say there's nothing wrong with that. Of course you're going to read the Constitution in light of what you think is best about it. And of course that's going to be a function of memory rather than history, and you see Thomas saying that explicitly. Now, Scalia doesn't say that explicitly, but if you actually look at his practice, it's much the same. When people analyzed, for example, his takings clause jurisprudence, it's very inconsistent with what historians will tell you about protections for property in the 18th century. Both Scalia and Thomas believe that the 14th Amendment enshrines a value of colorblindness because classifications based upon race are degrading. Neither one looks at the practices of the Congress that proposed or the practices of the nation that ratified the 14th Amendment. Both Scalia and Thomas believe that the 11th Amendment stands for principles of federalism that each one understands was not true of the 11th Amendment as a matter of original intention, not true in the text, but they believe in these principles of 11th Amendment interpretation because they believe that they're right, that they're proper, that we should be a country that respects states' rights and so forth and so on. Now, something is emerging here that I just want to flag for you, which I'll be more explicit about later. And that is to say that Scalia could condemn, and this is his word, as idiots. He says they are idiots, people who believe that the Constitution, quoting him now, will become brittle and break if it does not change with society. And yet I want to suggest to you, if you actually look at the jurisprudence of Scalia and Thomas, they do exactly that. They take a set of values which become resurgent in the 1980, and they read it into the Constitution. They read it into the Constitution in the form of the political practice of originalism. And I want to make an even more radical claim. I said to you that the phenomenon of originalism is distinct as an historical phenomenon. The phenomenon of originalism that I'm pointing to is distinct because it becomes a center for the mobilization of the right. So politicians use originalism, you see Bush use originalism in terms of his appointments of justices, to arouse right-wing voters, to get them active and mobilized and organized. And I want to say to you, Scalia and Thomas do exactly the same thing. And I'm not referring here to the kinds of speeches that they give to the Federalist Society. It's kind of a striking thing that they do give these speeches to the Federalist Society because both Scalia and Thomas have said the reason why we're opposed to a living constitutionalism is that the Constitution should be the province of a law-politics distinction, number one. So it should be under the control of the legal profession, which is distinct from politics. So, says Scalia very explicitly in his article on originalism, if the Constitution weren't a legal text which legal experts could interpret, there would be no business of the court engaging in judicial review at all because the political branches would be better able to interpret the Constitution. And yet here they are, despite this very strong law-politics distinction, each routinely giving speech after speech to organizations which have an overt political agenda. I'm not referring to that. I think it's odd, but I'm not referring to it. I'm going to refer instead to a different genre. And my text for the moment is going to be Scalia's dissent in Lawrence, which is a really remarkable document. Lawrence, you recall, is the case in which the court strikes down as unconstitutional under the Due Process Clause Texas's statute prohibiting sodomy. And Scalia writes this stinging, brilliant dissent, and he wants to discredit the court's opinion, and I'm quoting him now, as the product of a law profession culture that has largely signed on to the so-called homosexual agenda. That's Scalia talking. So notice, even though his philosophy separates the law and politics as the Constitution should be part of a legal profession, here he begins his opinion by discrediting the legal profession and say the legal profession is politicized. And then he says, the court tells you, in its opinion, that this will not lead to gay marriage. And then he has this remarkable sentence. He says, do not believe it. Now, my question to you is, who is he talking to when he says do not believe it? Is he talking to Kennedy? Is he saying, Kennedy, do not believe it? Is he talking to the law clerks? I mean, who is he saying do not believe it? Who exactly is that? Who's the addressee of that sentence, precisely? I think Scalia knows full well who the addressee of that sentence is. It's the right-wing groups who are going to get mobilized to put pressure on the president to appoint justices who will overturn Lawrence. And, of course, that's exactly what happens. Scalia's dissent is quoted instantly in fundraising flyers throughout the whole Internet and right-wing networks to raise money to say, well, we need to. There's a famous site called Impeach the Twisted Six. Impeach the six who voted for the court's opinion in Lawrence. And this is a perfectly common form of political mobilization in America, and Scalia is doing it deliberately. Do not believe it, he tells these people. Get out there and pressure the president, because if you don't pressure the president, you're going to lose this one. So this is somebody who is practicing the political practice of originalism quite effectively and quite brilliantly. And in journalism at the time, it was said, I'm just quoting now an article, I could quote any number of them, it says, sparking the mobilization against Lawrence was Justice Antonin Scalia's warning made in his dissent in the Supreme Court sodomy case that extending private rights to gay relationships would inevitably lead to same-sex marriage. He knew what he was doing. He was doing exactly what I said that the phenomenon of originalism started doing in the 1980s, and he's doing it from the bench. So this political practice of originalism occurs on the bench, and it occurs off the bench. So if we compare the jurisprudence of originalism and the political practice of originalism, we will see that the political practice of originalism does not efface the law-politics distinction. It's a way of introducing into law a certain kind of politics, a conservative politics. It does not preserve an original democratic will. It's a way of introducing in the Constitution a certain memory of what the United States is or should be. It does not fix the Constitution in light of a certain text. It's a way of bringing the Constitution in line with a certain conservative vision. So, we are led to a kind of paradox. The jurisprudence of originalism was developed to attack the left-wing notion of a living Constitution. What's a living Constitution? It's a Constitution that is responsive to contemporary values, to vibrant political values that was on the left. And so the notion of a living constitution, actually the first time I see it is in Carl Llewellyn by way of defending the New Deal, but you see it throughout the Warren Court as a way of defending the contemporary values which the Warren Court is supposedly talking about. Originalism comes along and says, forget those precedents, forget the living constitutionalism, there's a law-politics distinction. But actually, if you look at the political practice of originalism, it's a way of introducing into the Constitution vibrant, contemporary, living values, the living values of the right. And if you want a perfect illustration of that, toss your mind back to Edward Meese's speech in 1987 at Tulane. Right? If you think of popular constitutionalism now, we think of it as a left-wing phenomenon. We think of Larry Kramer, we think of Mark Tushnet, we think, you know, popular, get rid of the court. The first person since 1980, is Edward Meese, who in his speech gives a departmentalist vision of constitutional law. He says the Supreme Court decisions does not establish a supreme law of the land that is binding on all persons and parts of the government henceforth and forevermore, because constitutional interpretation is not the business of the court only, but also properly the business of all branches of government. So he says the political branches need to interpret the Constitution in light of their political mandate. This was this caused a firestorm of criticism. But his departmentalism is by way of opening up originalism to the political influences, which are at that point beginning to dominate the presidency and beginning to make their appearance in Congress. And in the very first issue of the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy, some of you may know that journal, it's now the house organ of the Federal Society and has been a conservative organ since its origin. The very first issue contains an article saying that what we need, originalism, can only be preserved if we have a constitutional amendment, which would, and I'm quoting the article now, allow Congress and the President acting together to overrule a Supreme Court interpretation of the Constitution. Now, this is saying the Constitution, explicitly saying, the Constitution should be open to political influence because, of course, the political influence is that which is expressed in the presidency and the Congress, and you couldn't get a more overt connection between originalism and political mobilization. Now, what this tells me is all of the critique of originalism which has been made in the scholarly journals, and there's a lot of it, and I'm part of that have done that, misses the point. It just misses the point. Because the strength of originalism does not lie in its logical arguments about democratic will and about fixity and about a law politics distinction. The strength of originalism lies in the fact precisely that it is a form of living constitutionalism that translates vibrant and effective political values into the language of constitutional law. And the authority of originalism will continue so long as appeals to originalism motivates voters to elect presidents who will appoint justices who say they are originalist, meaning by that they will make decisions which express the values of the electorate. And so when legal scholars like myself have attacked originalism on jurisprudential ground, we haven't gotten the real point. The real point is that you're up against a constitutional substantive vision. So when I said to you before, it's very unusual to see political mobilization around a methodology of constitutional interpretation, actually, I think, a better interpretation of originalism is that it is not mobilization around a methodology of interpreting the Constitution, as though everyone out there were worried about how actually you should read a text. It's mobilization around a substantive vision of the Constitution. And legal scholars like myself have difficulties with this because our job is to preserve the law-politics distinction. Our job is to teach students that the law is distinct from politics, has its own logic, which is pure and autonomous from politics. But if you actually look at the historical phenomenon of originalism, what you see is something quite different, that our constitutional law does have components of professional reason, but it also is responsive to reason incarnate in the body politics, reason that is political and that makes itself known to constitutional law through processes of mobilization and appointment and so forth and so on. And the success of originalism is precisely that kind of success. Now, the irony deepens because if you look at liberals or progressives on the other side of this, right? Liberalism in the Warren Court era defended itself as saying living constitutionalism. There is no law-politics distinction that's straight. We need to have a constitutionalism that's responsive to values. Right? So the left says living constitutionalism. What has the left been doing in recent years? Think about the Roberts hearings and the Alito hearings. What has been the Democratic position? The Democratic position is precedence, independence of the judiciary, rule of law. That's to say, the left has said living constitutionalism, but they've practiced precisely the law-politics distinction. The defense of the left-wing position in politics has been the autonomy of law. And so someone like Phyllis Schlafly looks at the left-wing position and she says, the new battle cry of the liberals is their sanctimonious mantra that we must have an independent judiciary. She says what they really mean is independent from the Constitution. So the left is thinking it can defend its constitutional vision by defending a law-politics distinction and the autonomy of the law. And if the analysis I've given you is correct, that's a loser. That's a loser. Because voters don't go out to the polls to elect the independence of the judiciary. They go out to the polls because they care about a certain substantive vision of what the Constitution is. And so long as the left has been maneuvered into the position of defending what they attacked in the Warren Court era, whereas the right, in the name of originalism, has been defending a vibrant substantive constitutional vision, the left is going to lose. So I have a colleague, Jack Balkin, right? He's about to publish an article called Left-Wing Originalism. So he's going to go back to the records of the Constitution that proposed the 14th Amendment and show what they really meant to do is protect abortion. I don't think that's going to convince anybody. What will convince people is some substantive vision about what the Constitution is for or against. So there's a lot of practical implications to the logic I'm putting on the table here. That is to say, if we imagine the future of the country as a debate between a right-wing and a left-wing form of constitutionalism, that debate cannot be joined unless the left gets its act together and actually has a substantive vision of what it thinks the Constitution is for or against. But instead, the left has been retreating precisely to methodology and to the autonomy of law. And that's not a position of constitutional strength, as we can see from the history of originalism. Now, what is the strength of originalism? I want to suggest to you something like this. I think that originalism appeals to sectors of the electorate that feels threatened by changes in modernity. They feel that traditional family values, that their traditional commitments to certain religious values, that their notions of gender, that their notions of property have been endangered. And they believe that the court, because of its prominence during the Warren Court era, is the agent of the destruction of these important values. And so originalism appeals to them by way of restoring what they view as an authentic vision of America. It's very interesting if you analyze that vision, right? Now they understand themselves to be in the middle of a conflict. Back then, when originalism appeals to, there was no conflict. We were one thing. And that's why originalism has force. So the notion of conflict is displaced and disappeared as we go back into a golden age of the past where there was no conflict. There was only one image, and it's whatever this group happens to think originalism is. And this is associated with their vision of restoring America to its values before it was corrupted by judicial interventions. And if you think I'm exaggerating here, I'm going to do, before I close, a quick reading of one such group. I could pick any number of hundreds that you see here, but I'm just going to pick one because we're in Virginia now. This is a group that is a Virginia group called the Liberty Council. You may know it. It's a nonprofit litigation, education, and policy organization that's affiliated to Jerry Falwell's Liberty University. And what's its mission? This is its mission: restoring the culture one case at a time by advancing religious freedom, the sanctity of human life, and the traditional family. Now, this is a mission which it advocates in the name of originalism. So what does the traditional family have to do with text, with original? What this is overtly is an attempt to restore culture. So Matthew Staver, who's the president and general counsel of this Liberty Council organization, condemned Bush when Bush nominated Harriet Myers, because Harriet Myers, quoting him now, did not respect the rule of law, and she would not have been a conservative voice on the High Court. Staver urged Bush, quote, to keep his campaign promise to appoint justices who respect the rule of law and who will remain loyal to the purpose and intent of the Constitution, end quote. And he cautioned the president, quote, not to take your conservative base or people of faith for granted again. I urge you to continue the conservative movement to bring the High Court back to, he says, the Constitution. And then Bush nominates Alito, and the organization on its website, organizationally, praises Bush, praises this nomination because it says that the president, quote, now, was keeping his campaign promise to nominate candidates to the Supreme Court who respect the rule of law and will decide cases on a principled basis instead of imposing their will by judicial fiat. The Liberty Council said that Alito was the kind of justice, quoting now, who would respect the Constitution and will interpret the law, not legislate from the bench. When the High Court issues decisions based purely on ideology, using international law or subjective sociological perceptions, it loses the respect of lower court judges, and most importantly, it loses the respect of the American people. Now, those are passages, I could pick hundreds of passages like that. But notice, just to give you a brief gloss on them, first of all, it says, we want to respect the original purpose and intent of the Constitution. What is that? It's conservative. It says it's a conservative ideology, it's a conservative base. The conservative vision of the Constitution is identified with the rule of law, is identified with the Constitution itself, and fidelity to a conservative vision of the Constitution is associated with what the law requires as distinct from subjective sociological perceptions, which is the liberal. Right? This is pure memory. This is purely exactly what I was describing to you as the political practice of originalism. The connection of ideology with a particular understanding of the Constitution is absolutely overt and clear in this passage. The Constitution is identified with the body of the nation that has been corrupted by Warren Court precedents, that are corrupted by judges who don't have the pure conservative vision, which is the Constitution. So here we see an absolutely explicit, naively explicit, because of course this isn't an academic, doesn't know how to dress it up, identification of conservatism with the ideology of originalism. Now, what I want to suggest to you is this is not a bad thing. This is what all of us do all the time. This is the nature of politics. Politics sets memory against memory. It sets substantive vision against substantive vision. The problem here are legal academics who want to draw a line and a fence between a substantive vision of the Constitution and constitutional law, as if that were either plausible or desirable. If you actually look how constitutional law is made, is always made. It's in the trenches of this kind of conflict about what do we stand for as a people. This is conflict. And liberals, when they attempt to defend themselves on the ground of the rule of law, mistake the conflict. They mistake the ground of the conflict. What they need to do, if they're going to meet this challenge, is to have their own substantive vision of what the Constitution stands for. I know there's different metaphors you could use. You see underlying the metaphor of originalism is the metaphor of restoration, returning us to the way we were. You could have a different metaphor. You could say redemption. Right? Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. It's the redemption of the Czech, says Martin Luther King in that speech. You know, there's many different metaphors you could have that ties a political vision to the Constitution. It's the work of legal academics and judges to make the connection between a particular political vision and the Constitution. That's what we do, actually. Although we don't say we're doing it, I think that's what we do. And certainly as an historian, if you look at the actual way the Constitution is made, this is what has happened. Now, it may be irreverent, it may even be sacrilege to say that in a law school, but I think if we look at the history of originalism, I don't know what other lesson to draw from it.